You are listening to Beautiful Minds, the podcast. Beautiful Minds captures honest and optimistic conversations with smart, passionate, and genuine people who seek to change the world for the better. For now, we're starting small with a series of portraits of individuals who, in 2011, got together to study human rights in Europe. They came from different places, different backgrounds, and had very different stories. All they had in common was their appetite for social justice and a motivation to make a difference. Almost a decade later, let's see where they are, what they've done, and what they've learned. At Beautiful Minds, we start small and we dream big. Thank you for tuning in, and let's get started. Hi, Ezekiel. Thank you so much for joining me and joining us today. It's super cool to have you on the podcast. You actually did the exact same masters, you know, than the one I've talked about in the first few episodes. But before we get on to this, I wanted to say, of course, welcome. Where are you? How's your week going? I mean, is tomorrow a bank holiday as well in London? I forgot, you know, what you guys celebrate.
Yes, I'm in London. Hi, Morgan. Thank you so much for reaching out. How to everybody else listening in. London, yeah, tomorrow is a bank holiday. It's a Victory in Europe Day. The lockdown is now 8 weeks here. And apparently, you know, in a few days, they might be announcing an ease of that. But I don't think it's going to be very much the same. And it might be actually very weird to go out of the house.
Yeah, let's see how that goes, and let's see how it is by the time this comes out, you know, in a few weeks. But all right, so as I was saying, you studied the same masters as the one I did, as the one the few previous guests, you know, on this podcast did. So I wanted to kind of bring you back to graduation time, you know, and I was actually at your graduation.
You were there.
I don't know if you remember, but I was there, which is super funny, you know. Do you remember what your mindset was? Do you remember what you had in mind? Do you remember what you did, you know, right after this graduation? And I want to bring you a little bit to talking about transitioning onto the job market, you know, and if for you this was, you know, a smooth, fun, and easy time, or if you were a bit fearful, and if you were fearful of what, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost, I mean, maybe exactly by the time this is out, 5 years since that moment. And I think at that time, you know, it was very emotional. There were 2 years of, you know, traveling around with a cohort of people, your friends. And it was also very, you know, anxiety in terms of what is going to happen next. And I remember that same night, right after the ceremony or whatever, we went out to the Shakespeare's Head pub, which is a nearby one from the university. And yeah, we all were pretty much thinking of, you know, what is really the next step. But for me, I think, you know, that master's was really helpful in trying to understand in my head what this human rights sector is. And I think that semester here in London was really useful for that. And to me in particular, I think I was lucky enough to make the transition quite smooth. I was already working by the time that graduation happened. And it's because of that last semester placement in London, which was easy to kind of say, okay, I'm going to look for something that might be helpful for that transition. And yeah, I ended up with you at that time, obviously, in Amnesty, and not too far from each other. Actually, we were working in the same floor, at least.
That's right, Yeah.
So it wasn't a too difficult transition. But I think in absence of that placement and in absence of that semester to play around with, you know, how do you talk to people? What do you ask them for? What job do you really want to do? I think without that, it would have been really difficult. And not necessarily because of London, but because of the practice of being in a big city and having to fend your way, basically, having to try to make spaces for you and to try to see whether those actually lead you anywhere.
So sorry, I'm interrupting, but talk me for a little bit, you know, your entry into the Amnesty world, you know. How did this kind of become an actual full-time permanent job where you've grown, you know, a lot within the organization?
I mean, I think it's an accident. I think it's really an accident, a bit of a combination of luck and an accident. It happened, I mean, from the very beginning of this and how I ended up in Amnesty. Back in the first semester in Sweden, in Gothenburg, there was the, you know, the usual Human Rights Week conference. So we all took a train and we went to Stockholm for a few days. And in one of the panels of that conference, they were discussing the International Criminal Court, which was and still is the topic that I research. So I remember after that going to talk to Kirsten Mercert. Maybe I'm chopping her last name. I'm sorry if you're listening. But she was at the time the legal officer for the Coalition for the International Criminal Court. And she said to me that, you know, if I'm going to be in London, you know, one of the biggest members of that coalition is Amnesty. Obviously, I knew Amnesty. And then she gave me a name and agreed to put me in contact with, at that time in Amnesty, the legal advisor on these issues, Towanda Hondora. I reached out to him. We went for a coffee and we kept in touch. We kept in touch for when I'm back in London, because I was towards the end of the semester. And when I was back, I contacted him. He actually did a tour of the old building by then, of Amnesty. And then he told me of a few internships coming up. And the quickest that I could get because of the timings was in the campaigns team. And that was a volunteer role. It was a volunteer role for about 2.5 months until the first kind of opening that I saw on the governance program. So looking at how Amnesty is governed and what kind of strategy they want to create and what kind of decision making they have in place. And that was my first job. And it was in the beginning, it was a 6-month contract. It ended up being a year. And after that, I transitioned into other positions. But it was a little bit of luck and a little bit of an accident.
And you're still there.
And I'm still there. Yeah, which is surprising. I did not plan to stay long, to be honest.
I think you know that I'm interested in this, you know, and I gave you some kind of, you know, pointers to maybe prep a little bit your thinking about. But I'm highly, highly interested in this kind of tension between, you know, the legal side of the human rights mobilization movement and the political side of it, you know. You come from a legal background, but you work in literally the most politicized, you know, human rights organization in the world, one of the most politicized, right? Amnesty. Yeah. So I'm kind of wondering how you position your own human rights work or the human rights work of the organization within that spectrum, you know, and if you ever feel this tension, you know, in your practice between a legal agenda that actually has been, you know, quite highly, has been widespread criticism towards kind of an over-focus, you know, yeah, on the legalization of human rights. And by that, I mean the kind of crystallization of rights into a legal arsenal, you know, at all levels, you know, both at a regional level in Europe, but also at a global level. And a more political activism side of the mobilization movement around human rights. I wonder if you personally feel it in your work and if you've come across this in your work and in your practice. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed the assessment. I think that tension is very much present. And I would venture to say that it's very present in Amnesty because it's a very old organization based on principles of organizing, you know, responses to human rights violations that is very much a UK cultural way of doing it, right? So they start from the standard and the law. And then maybe they trickle down to what is the context, the sociology and the anthropology of the issue. And to be honest, that is one of the main reasons why I really did like to do the master's degree that we did, because sociology and aspects of philosophy were there. And I think these organizations that end up having to choose between, do I do litigation and outside the courts, I have a large movement of people that are actually protesting for the principle of that litigation, but not on Article 12 2C and the whatever Latin term you want to throw in there. And I think that tension is very present, and specifically in Amnesty because of that hierarchy that it has in its history. Now, I do think there is an opportunity now, especially in the context where, sadly, perhaps laws and standards matter less. You say that convention or this treaty, or that you talk about this ruling or that ruling, doesn't really make much sense in the eyes of governments or even of people who might be less interested in the why the law, but more on the how is it used and for what purpose, and does it benefit me? And most of the times we see that laws, even if they're progressive, they can be repressive when you actually apply them. And I think organizations like Amnesty have to take a step back and even think through, do I need to hire an economist, for example, right? Because a lot of these issues end up having some sort of repercussion at the state level in terms of how budgets are allocated or how fiscal policies work, how taxation works as one of the gateways for inequality. And we are not, right? Or Amnesty is not, or big organizations are not. And that is, I think, because they are trapped in their own history. And it's very difficult to push an elephant in a dark room, right? So I think, you know, to your question, I think that tension will be there for some time. I don't think COVID-19 is catastrophic enough, although it is, for these organizations to change. I think it probably will be climate change. It might be the disempowerment of people not wanting to pay attention to these NGOs anymore. And it definitely is the origins of their history. These are northern, mostly white men, European conceptions of how power relies on NGOs. But in other places, in places I've been at least in Argentina that I know well, it's a very different vibe. It's more on the politics, on the sociology, on the how we elevate a violation to the extent of being a mass communication item rather than, oh, you violated law, so and so. So that tension, I think, will be there. And I'm not sure it will disappear in the north, but in the south, I don't know what is your experience on it in Myanmar, but I think in places like Argentina, it's more contested.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, what kind of strikes me when you say as well is this tension between economic, social, and cultural rights as well and the kind of first generation of civil and political rights. You know, I think there is a very kind of northern, southern kind of, you know, gap between these two generations of rights and what is prioritized in each place. And I think what I had seen, you know, when I was at Amnesty, and you and I overlapped for, I think, at least 2 years, right, from 2015 to 2017, was around the campaign on the refugee crisis, you know, the Syrian refugee crisis. I think this was a very striking example of this, you know, tension between a discourse that was saying it is illegal not to accept people who are seeking the right to asylum and not to, you know, explore the grounds for these kind of claims. But at the same time, people were saying, yeah, but, you know, jobs and we don't want to share resources and it's overwhelming and it's too many and all of that, right? So I think this was a great, sad example of that tension. But as you know, I don't want to talk in this podcast about only things that don't work. You know, I mean, obviously, I welcome, you know, this podcast being a place where we actually voice out concerns, you know, and doubts, and we kind of reflect back on our experience. But I also really, really want listeners that are not necessarily super familiar with the human rights sector to kind of come away with hope, you know, and with kind of a bank of examples of things that actually work, right? So we've been highlighting a few tensions, and we'll go back to the legal side of human rights a little bit later in this episode, but basically, I want to ask you a question that I'm asking a lot of people, which is what works, you know, what actually works and why and how and what is different, what can be replicated, what could be kind of scaled up. Those are the things I'm really, really interested in, both in my academic research project, but also just in my everyday life as a person who kind of wants to find hope. I was wondering if you had any example, you know, of things you had been involved in or you had the chance to witness, you know, that were really good kind of success stories that for you kind of reflect a bit of a recipe for success when it comes to human rights mobilization of some sort. So I don't know if you have some great example that will make us happy or make me happy at least.
Yeah, I mean, I have two examples in mind, but maybe I want to say before I talk about those examples, a bit of what I think might be the preconditions for things to work.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, if we think about human rights organizations, there are so many, they are so diverse, but they all tend to relate around issues of equality, justice, social justice, you know, the ability of people to have the same level and access of opportunity, right? I mean, quote unquote, obviously a simplification, but that's a bit of the idea. Now, human rights change is difficult. And although it is possible, I think it has to, two things have to happen for that to happen. The first thing is, you know, don't start with the anxiety that it will happen tomorrow. it will take time, and that time it is necessary for things to start changing progressively. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that persistence, that understanding that a lot of that change is actually built on resilience. So we want to, you know, create new marvelous treaties, or we want to mobilize people for a certain discrimination, or we want to identify an issue for the state to care more about. Doing it over time and constantly and refining the way you do it is key for that to happen. With those two things, I think many changes that we want to see won't happen. And I have one example in mind, which I was part of very tangibly. When I was back in university doing my bachelor's, I worked for a summer with an organization, you know, working on housing rights in Latin America. And I had a chance to be in Haiti for some time, in Port-au-Prince for some time. And the way that they decided to work on issues so difficult as housing in a context of several vulnerabilities and practically no state budget for it, is to really look at the community empowerment model. And I think that works really well across different sectors. Like the healthcare sector is probably the best one that it works. But in this particular example, you know, big organizations that are able to amplify issues, they used to do it at places they could fundraise to then give that money straight to the people and the communities on the ground for them to decide how they wanted to organize themselves, for them to decide what investments were needed first, and for them to be accountable for mistakes that could happen, but not from the point of view of punitive mistakes, from the point of view of learning mistakes. So what happened that summer? There was a drive of fundraising. They got some sort of budget that they needed, and mostly the program that were looking at those community agents, because of what a lot of the practice and theory said, you know, we identified women. Women are the champions of the communities. I mean, this is something we see again and again and again, and it's true. Like, whoever is listening to this, don't find more articles to read. The first one was right. And what happened there is that, you know, they decided that for housing rights, for the ability of everybody to have a place, a dwelling to live with conditions of sanitation and conditions of enough space to, you know, to carry out the livelihoods, they didn't really yet need those units. They first needed a school. Mm. Because the school is a place where kitchens work, where children can be attended to, and where community initiatives actually start. And it became more of a creative hub for a community that wanted to keep investing rather than, oh, let's create a school and let's only do education in that building. It was the other way around. And that school wasn't built at the time I was there, but the whole design of the idea, and to see how the community itself figured this out, there was nothing, and obviously this is very colonial language, right? But a lot of these NGOs don't understand that, and they still believe that the blueprints that they printed in their fancy PDFs in their offices is going to work. And it usually doesn't work. So in terms of the two conditions in this example, it worked really well. And I check with them once in a while with the team. And then obviously they have now 7 schools in that district. And I think they had at the beginning 10,000 units they needed to start with. And now I think they're about 3,000 units created. And it's because of social entrepreneurship programs of that school and many other services that they were able to provide to the same community. And that is human rights. That is thinking, you know, I have an issue. There is an injustice. I organize around it. I make sure I got, you know, empowerment as a unit of analysis. And then later on, with those who actually will do the work, doing it themselves rather than create this, I guess, artificial ways of thinking about problems where somebody from the outside who has nothing to do with that context ends up being the one leading it, which is, I think, the wrong way of doing human rights work.
No, that's right. And I think, you know, sometimes we look for social innovation in the wrong places, right? We look for it in kind of fancy offices in Washington, D.C., you know, or in the Silicon Valley, because we think this is what innovation should look like, you know, from like really highly educated people. But I think, you know, there is a lot happening on the ground, like people were kind of at the forefront of both human rights violations and human rights kind of work and answers that actually innovate in the most amazing way, you know, and either we don't record it systematically or sometimes, you know, we just kind of miss it or we overlook it. But there is so much innovation happening, you know, on the ground by the people who are just the first responders, you know, to crisis. And it's amazing to look at what they do.
Yeah, and very quickly, a second example right now happening as we speak in Argentina, due to the increase of violence against women in a context of lockdown, there's been a campaign by activists to identify women who might be suffering through this lockdown with some any item of clothing that is red. So if you were to go on your one-a-day outing to the supermarket or to the kiosk or to whatever, and you see somebody wearing, clearly the red color is coming out, that meant that person, that woman, that other individual is actually in danger or is actually, you know, living through a situation of that particular human rights violation. And with that, alerting the police and the whole protocol of a view of making sure that person is supported. And it's worked very well. In many, many places, they saw a decline in calling to the emergency number, but they saw an increase in police being involved in trying to mediate these spaces. And that happened through, you know, activists that go organized, decided on a caller, decided on how to operationalize it. And it was WhatsApps, a couple of flyers, and then go for the
word
practice.
Word of mouth and just...
And that's it. No fancy monitoring evaluation framework, no fancy platforms, no fancy meetings, nothing. Problem, solution, do it. And then with that, hopefully refine it.
No, it's really funny you mentioned this, and it's a great example. And I love this kind of stories. You know, I mean, I love that it works, not that it's necessary, of course. But I've been, you know, thinking a little bit recently about how this current kind of sanitary crisis is giving space for people to pilot, you know, certain approaches and to innovate as well, because it's such a disruption to our everyday life and to the kind of normal, whatever normal is supposed to be, right? But to this normal situation, that it gives both kind of public services and kind of public authorities, but also activists and also just individuals that are not necessarily, you know, linked to any organizations, kind of space to innovate and to try different things, you know, and when things kind of return to a little bit more stable times and you know, when people are back to work, I think it would be really super interesting to kind of gather, you know, a list of this sorts of initiatives, like the one you mentioned, that actually just were very easy to implement, didn't, you know, need a lot of resources and just worked, you know? So I think there will be a lot to learn in the future from what has happened in the COVID period. Back on this idea of learning, you know, I just said there will be a lot of things to learn. So I'm thinking very often about this kind of very philosophical deep question of what does success look like, you know, in the human rights field? I don't know if you have a similar kind of approach to what you think is success, you know, in our field, because of course there is this extremely long-term kind of, you know, goal where we want all the kids to be educated and no one to die under the age of 5 because of malnutrition. And all of this is very clear, but it's also very, very abstract and very kind of, you know, long down the road. So I wonder how you find satisfaction in the kind of medium term, you know, like everyday life of your work and where you think, okay, this was a successful moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a question that lots of people in this sector grapple with a lot of anxiety. Because obviously, I think most people, you know, independently they work in this sector or in another one, they actually do really want to see that kid under 5 being fed every day. Or they actually do want to see Article 1 to 30 of the Human Rights Declaration actually being fulfilled. They actually do want that. And it's really frustrating when you put yourself to do that, and then it really doesn't happen. And when you look at why it doesn't happen, you know, you start seeing that maybe it's a lot more complex than you thought. And then you become into that spiral of being, you know, disillusioned. I don't do that. I think I've been able to put like rooms in my head where I put those thoughts, and then I try not to open that door because it's just not useful. I don't think there is a lot of utility in getting defeated by the not being able to achieve what nobody has achieved in hundreds of years. I don't think I'm that hero or pioneer to be able to do it in one go. So, but what I do think about learning is that I think the question here is about calibration of success, right? So success is very contextual. So if we say, okay, I'm going to have to, you know, there is clearly an issue at the state level, and I need to talk to this minister to issue whatever document or whatever it might be that might stop that violation. I think the moment you get a reply on that meeting request, I think that's success already. And I will feel happy about that first step. And then I'll feel happy when we meet. And I'll think that is also success because that person, you know, I've been able to influence somebody or people, whatever context, to have that meeting. And then the repercussions after that is external to my area of control. And I think that's something that, you know, human rights practitioners need to be more aware of. There are areas of control that are really beyond ourselves. And we shouldn't be thinking that, you know, because we don't have control over them, maybe not yet, you know, failure is all we get. And also reflection. I'm not sure this human rights sector in general is very good at stop, reflecting, continue. I think it's very good at continue, continue, continue. And if we don't really stop, reflect, and actually let time for the thought to sink and learn from it, then I think we are doomed to continue to think that because we haven't achieved success, we need to double down on the strategy we have rather than stop, maybe do something else for a while. If we have that privilege and if we have the time, obviously, and the money, which is difficult, but at least have a moment of check-in and say, I think that we actually did achieve success in this many levels. Maybe more than that, we can't, we couldn't. Now let's adapt what we have now to be able to get there. But then consolidate the gains. And something we definitely don't do in this sector is to celebrate those successes. So once in a while, a party is a good thing.
No, absolutely. I love a celebration. So you definitely spend a lot of time stopping and reflecting because you've recently embarked into a PhD program, right? So I think we were actually, when we were colleagues at Amnesty, we were both kind of talking about how we both wanted to do PhDs. And I remember you had sent me a spreadsheet with some names of universities that you had already, you know, researched. And so if I understand correctly, you're in the School of Law of Middlesex University. So when did you start your PhD? I think we started the same time, no?
Yeah, so I started the last bit of 2017. And I started really doing the research probably late middle of 2018. I'm doing a PhD, you know, for several reasons, but one of them is because of being able to access a supervisor like the one I'm glad to have. So I'm doing the PhD with William Shabas, which is very known in Myanmar, I think, for not, we can have a different podcast on that
I think we should. Maybe we could have a whole season, you know, about what's going on in Myanmar, and then you could come and talk about this. But can you do me a favor? Can you do us a favor? Can you just summarize your PhD topic? Make it accessible, make it understandable, and make it short.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've been practicing all my life for this. Very short, very crispy. The world created the International Criminal Court about 20 years ago. That court is a treaty. Every treaty has state parties, which are the ones that say, yeah, I want to do that. Okay, that's those state parties have been meeting for in a conference setting every year for 20 years. So I'm checking at the moment, what have they really accomplished? Have they done anything in those fancy big meetings in The Hague and New York? And can we see whether or not there is any repercussion in what the states decide and what the court actually does, which in theory, it shouldn't have any link because, you know, they're independent institutions. That's it. What have they done in 20 years? That's it. That's the research question.
That's excellent. I'm looking forward to the answer and to the conclusions in a few years. That sounds really cool. So can you tell me, sorry, I interrupted with my question about the topic, but I thought this was important. But tell us a little bit more about, you know, why you're doing this. How does that fit within your, well, one, within your career path, and also one within your kind of overall human rights education and practice, you know, and that's of course connected a little bit, but you know, if you can place this in your career.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very much linked to your very first question at the beginning of this podcast. So, you know, the tension between law and the other sciences in the human rights field. I'm always very interested in the law, and I always was, but I don't think is the end of the course in human rights. I think the politics of the law is actually where the magic happens. And this topic is actually marrying the two, because a lot of the decisions these states look inside that assembly, that conference that they have, is actually very, very political. How they appoint a judge has huge repercussions for the law, but actually it's a horse trading race with what can you appoint my country in another UN setting or in another multilateral organization? And that is a political question. That's not a legal question. So with this topic, I'm trying to get into a very good example of how the machinery of decision-making happens. The idea, obviously, is to try to take from that a lot of lessons about A, advocacy, what works, what doesn't, if you wanted to influence those spaces. But two, being less naive about these organizations and about state behavior in them. And number three, hopefully providing that assembly a few recommendations to the extent that they take them, on what actually is their role, because it's really not defined in the way that the court and the assembly actually work together. And I think in terms of my career path, these are issues I'm interested in, and I might as well know more about them than less. And I think that is the pursuit of the PhD. And also, obviously, you know, I said it in terms of having supervision that is very technical at this is really, really helpful. Because I, you know, for a lot of what I'm reading, I can already apply in some of the work that Amnesty does. And in others is, you know, the conversations that you have with different people in the sector. And we'll see. I mean, that's the objective. You know, probably later in my career or whenever this is done, I would like to transition to those kinds of organizations to see whether or not some of these findings are actually realistic.
No, absolutely. No, that sounds really great. I wish you all the best with this. I know how painful a PhD can be, but it's also amazing. You know, I had kind of marked down this question I wanted to ask you, which was, you know, what did you wish you had known prior to starting the PhD? You know, and I mean, to give you some time to think about it, I'm going to give you mine. You know, my main takeaway from this 1.5 year that I've been into the PhD process. And that's exactly about what you were just talking about, which is supervision. You know, I was lucky enough to actually end up being supervised by someone that I'm extremely grateful for, who's been an amazing supervisor. He doesn't know I'm doing this podcast, so I'm not actually trying to get, you know, bonus points. But but you know, he's been really, really great at supervising me, and I didn't really know how important this was going to play out, you know, to be. And now, if anyone was to ask me this advice, for now it's unsolicited advice, but you know, if anyone was to ask me, you know, what do you think is the key thing to think about when you apply or when you're kind of thinking about doing a PhD, I would say disregard the university, unless you really want to go to Oxford or, you know, Oxbridge, but, you know, disregard these kind of places, but look for a supervisor who's not only an expert in your field, but who's interested, you know, in your research project. Because you want someone who actually wants the answers to your questions almost as much as you do, right? Who's actually kind of interested in discovering what it is you're trying to uncover, you know? So that would be my takeaway from, you know, 1.5 year of PhD process. I don't know what would be yours.
I mean, people can see me, but I'm nodding heavily. yeah, I think that is number one. This is number one for me as well. And to be honest, I mean, I was a bit scared at the beginning. You know, we are talking about towering people in the field. These are not people that are going to, I mean, in this context, my supervisor will read anything and actually laugh at my mistakes. But that's after creating the space and a relationship that you're able to be vulnerable in front of experts. And that's not easy. That's definitely not easy. And that was a bit hard at the beginning. You don't know what quality you're expected to put in there, and that's something the supervisor will do for you in a way, right? I mean, it's obviously a journey and a back and forth conversation, but if that relationship is not very well calibrated, I have heard horrible stories about bad supervision. I have had none of those. And that's why I think more and more and more that that is actually key. Who is a person who's going to, in a way, coach you through the process? And the other thing I would say is expectation management and this fallacy of comparisons with others. That's something very prominent with other PhD students that I see, that they will focus more on how many conference papers they've been able to turn into or how many places they've gone in to speak. But at the end of the day, their chapter writing is not advancing, right? So, and that is none of their fault. It's the fault of this context in academia, at least, where there's competition of appearances, but then the actual work that you need to do never gets done because you have to be out there competing. And there isn't really time for anything else. And so expectation management is my number two, to say, I want to know more about this area. I'm going to do it in 3 to 4 to 5 years, whatever it takes. But I don't have to do it because I'm competing, or I don't have to do it because, you know, if I don't do it this way, I'm going to be perceived as a bad PhD student. Those two things combined, you know, it gives you a lot of peace of mind and a lot of space for being creative. And that's something I've been told many, many times by people finishing PhDs or associate professors just starting their careers, that they regret not spending more time in the PhD actually quoting the wrong books and quoting the wrong articles or doing the extra interview or you know, finding an extra database just for fun. And I think we have to remember that, yeah, research should be fun, hopefully. And from there onwards.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I'm having a lot of fun with mine. That's definitely, I'm ticking that box. The chapter writing, I'm not too sure, but the fun bit definitely is on my agenda. So that's happening on my side. So tell me, I mean, you're a lot of things, right? You're wearing a lot of hats. I mean, you're doing so many things, right? I was, obviously you and I are friends, you know, I've known you for a while. We were colleagues, but and you have such a rich life, right? You're doing so many things. So I'm wondering, who's your community? You know, where do you find a community of peers? You know, like, where do you find your support? Where do you find your communities? Who do you speak with, you know, to kind of bounce ideas off of them and of each other? And how do you grow?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure, to be honest. I don't think I have a defined community where I go and find support. I can tell you that most of the support I have is my inner family, the people I see every day. But I think, you know, when I'm confused about something or I really want to bounce ideas off, I tend to revert back to people from the whatever years I've been abroad from Argentina and even back home that are doing something different from what I'm doing. So I talk a lot about law with an economist. Because I just think they have a very different way of looking at my problem that is actually very helpful. Or when I'm in the human rights bubble, I guess in London at least, I tend to look for those who actually do more field work and not necessarily research field work, but more organizing field work. I think they have a better understanding of what are the conditions at ground level. But I actually don't have one single community. I never thought about it, to be honest, and I don't think I have only one. I come back to people across my life that they've done something different. Because I think I'm pretty much curious about what their ideas of things that maybe they are not familiar with, and they might throw a completely different angle. And that is how I learn, I think. That's really, really enriching. Or when I read, I don't know, I read poetry now because I'm sick of reading anything longer than three paragraphs. But that's so new as well, right? And it was a suggestion by an Indian friend. So I don't know, it's a bit random. I come back to this question maybe in a few years' time on your season 2000 of your podcast.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to this. I think we're approaching the end, you know, of this interview, but I want to ask you one more thing. You know, if someone were to approach you, and I'm sure it happens all the time, right? That you have young or younger people kind of coming to you and you know, saying, I'm thinking about doing I don't know, master's or bachelor in international affairs or human rights. I'm thinking about going onto the human rights field, you know, or into kind of development, international development. What would you want to tell these people? You know, now you're 5 years post-graduation, you've had a really interesting path. What is the one kind of, again, unsolicited advice you think we should give, you know, young kids who want to do this kind of careers?
Yeah, I mean, I usually tell them to be brave, because it isn't a very easy sector to get in. I think it might be slightly easier to move horizontally, and maybe a little bit vertically, but mostly horizontally. But it's not easy to get in. And that can be difficult if you're just, you know, starting to think about it. So to be able to be brave, I usually say that they need to know the sector pretty well, right? So what is the difference between an Amnesty and a Red Cross? They are pretty big, but they're still in the same, you know, ecosphere of what we might think human rights is. And I think knowing those distinctions can really help to then go to my third advice, which is send them an email. Like, you lose nothing. I think that's exactly how my luck and coincidence part with Amnesty was. Just send them an email. You know, don't be afraid of unsolicited advice either. The worst you can get is a no reply. So to be brave in that sense, you know the sector well, and then just go for the people that you think is mostly very interesting to you, and just chase them until you get some sort of answer, or chase others. And I think from there on, it's just to be very mindful that it isn't a marathon, it's a sprint, right? Or is it the other way around?
The other way around,
right. So the idea that you have to take... You have to be very careful of not rushing to saving the world, quote unquote. You know, there are different ways of doing it. There are many different people doing it in different ways in different parts of the world. And you can be one of those. So with a lot of patience and start learning from their own.
Build your empire step by step.
Yeah.
We're going to close really, really soon. Now it's happening. But what's coming up for you? You know, what's the next kind of big thing that you're excited about, you know, in your career or in your life or in your various projects? You know, what's the one thing that's looming, you know, coming close and that you're like, yes, this is going to be good?
Oof, a couple of things. You know, first of all, obviously, the PhD, I'm arriving to half point. So I'm hoping to start using some of that content and see how he lands on some of the people I'm trying to influence. So that I'm really looking forward to that. And, you know, a lot of the work that I might be doing with Amnesty or with a PhD, I usually find allies back home that are doing something similar. So there's a lot of collaborations with those people and to that extent. And I think it's really useful and interesting to see how many of those actually come alive. And there are two or three that might come alive in the next few months. So I'm going to be tapping into those. And then, just to be honest, generally, 2020 to be over. I'm hoping for 2021. 2020 was such a...
You're ready for
it. So we'll see how the 2021 comes aboard. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, career-wise, I couldn't tell you. I really don't know. I actually don't plan things that well in that sense. I just let it flow a bit.
Yeah,
but the other things,
that's even better. Let's, you know, keep ourselves open for opportunities. And I'm looking forward to following you, you know, in your next endeavors. And Ezekiel, thank you so much, you know, for playing along with me and, you know, my crazy endeavors on my side. I'm super grateful for your time, for all the lessons shared, you know, and the experience sharing. I think, you know, we are building these kind of communities, you know, on a daily basis. And I just want to kind of be able to share them, you know, with a broader audience, you know, because I think we're talking about really cool stuff. So thank you so much for doing this, and I will see you in season 2 when we talk about Myanmar and the ICC.
Yay, well, thank you very much, and yeah, looking forward to hear everybody else.